Very happy to welcome back to the Shilling Show, David Murata, who's the president of Murata Wealth Management. And today's topic, although we're going to start on a slightly different one, is countries with the most economic freedom and why you should even be concerned with that. David, welcome back to the Shilling Show.
Thank you so much.
One of the things that happens when you're coming on the air is we get people asking questions in advance. And we did have a caller yesterday who said, I know David's coming on. I'd like you to ask him a little bit. He was concerned about the fallout of the whole Fannie and Freddie issue and what's going on and how can individuals protect themselves from this. I get the impression that he's a responsible guy who's got a good loan that he's paid for and that he could afford, but he's bothered that, you know, we're all going to have to pay for this. So what do you say to our listener, Gary?
Yeah, both Fannie and Freddie are examples of the principle of economic freedom within a country. If Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are government-created agencies that have to run by government red tape and standards, and in the past, that's been the argument that a system like that can be run better because it's run centrally with social goods in mind. But now they're the poster childs for why government intervention, government rules, and government organizations could create more harm within a system than they create good. In this country, we have an amazing amount of economic freedom despite government agencies like this, such that when a company like Enron goes bankrupt, we just let it go. And letting it go is better than what y'all see in Japan when a company gets into trouble. They support it. They milk it. They can't imagine how you could let a company that big go. And it's a drain on their economy for years and years and years, which is why the United States is in the top 10 countries of economic freedom and Japan is not, and why the United States has been able to recover from our tech bubble and Japan is still waiting to recover from their bubble.
You know, what's interesting about that is there's talk of the U.S. government buying stock in these companies. And are you saying that we should just let them go? And what would happen if we did?
Yeah, the best answer for Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac is to simply not bail them out and not have a government takeover. The private industry is able to perform the same functions that they perform in a better way if you remove the government red tape.
Let's go to line number one. We already have a caller at 977-1070, and welcome Mike to the Shilling Show. Hey, Mike, how are you?
Hey, I'm well, Rob. I'm just at a loss because at first I'm vehemently disagreeing with the guest, and then I'm agreeing with the guest.
Okay.
I think that, you know, you live by the sword, you die by the sword, and if you're going to lie, cheat, and steal, you know, you should pay the consequences, and I think that's pretty much what went on with Enron and Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. But I also think that there's a real role for government to play, and that is in regulation. People should not be allowed to lie, cheat, and steal. You need policemen in business just the same as you need policemen. In fact, probably even more so in your everyday life. These people committed high financial crimes. Their executives are walking away with millions of dollars, and taxpayers and homeowners who bought their homes, you know, at $300,000 but are now going to see their homes worth only $180,000, $200,000, those are the people that are left holding the bag. So there is a need for a strong police regulatory state when you're dealing with these complex financial transactions, because in the end, it's the unsophisticated home buyer that's paying the price, and it shouldn't be that way. I'm going to hang up and wait for comments.
Hey, thank you very much for the call, Mike. Always good to hear from you.
Sure.
All right. So what do you have to say about Mike's dissertation?
There is no question that people are getting into loans they shouldn't be getting into. There's also no question that the government has encouraged people to get into loans that they shouldn't be getting into with all of the requiring of banks to loan to lower income and underprivileged and
essentially people who could not afford to take.
Right. We set up laws that would cause banks to not be able to do what they want to do if any community group complained about it. And then community groups formed simply to get banks to make more loans they shouldn't be making. And the premise on that, on all of that legislation, was to encourage homeownership, because the premise was homeownership builds wealth. It turns out homeownership is not the quickest way to build wealth. A home is a liability. It's not an asset. An asset is something that pays you money. A liability is something that you pay money to. And so the presumption was that banks could afford to do it because banks always make money on their loans. Well, they always make money on their loans because they don't loan to people they shouldn't. So the House of Cards was kicked out by the legislation requiring banks to loan to people they shouldn't be loaning to. And then those people took houses, and then their houses went up in value. They refinanced, took more money out of the house, spent it. The house went up in value. They took more money out of the house and spent it, and they used their houses like ATM machines. Then when the house goes down in value, well, they could never afford the payments in the first place if the house didn't keep going up in value. And so now they're foreclosing. I'm not sure how many of those are victims and how many of those have actually gotten hundreds of thousands of dollars out of an appreciating house and are now walking away from the loan because the house isn't going up in value anymore. So, I mean, I feel sorry for people that can't do that can't make their payments on the one hand. And on the other hand, some of them never could have made their payments in the first place. And through refinancing their house, have actually taken equity away from the bank and put it in their pocket.
Mike is actually back with us. Mike, you obviously have a retort here.
Yeah, just because I think that answer was fundamentally dishonest and it glossed over the real problem. The real problem isn't, you know, your blue-collar worker that took out a $120,000 loan to buy his first home for him and his family. The real problem are these people that took out $400,000 or $500,000 in loans and kept going back to the banks, who are making aggressive loan offers for HELOCs, home equity lines of credit, because banks were riding this bubble. They saw the real estate prices, you know, just escalating at a pace that just wasn't sustainable. Real estate prices, everybody in economics knows, they cannot escalate faster than people's incomes escalate.
Mike, let me ask you a quick question because we're running out of time here. We're coming up against a break. But do you disagree with David's premise that banks were forced to loan money in places and in situations where they didn't make actual financial sense for them to do so? Do you disagree with that?
Yeah, I disagree that that's the cause of the problem.
But do you disagree that it happened?
Redlining and legislation addressed redlining and a whole bunch of other stuff.
But Mike, let me just ask you, do you disagree that it happened? Not that it was the problem, but that it happened.
I'm saying that did not cause this problem.
Right, but I'm going to ask you the question one more time, and then we're going to head into a break. Do you disagree that it happened? Did the government force banks to make loans that were not financially feasible for them?
No, I don't think the government ever required banks to commit to making loans that weren't financially feasible to their customers.
Okay. Mike, we're heading up on a hard break here. Thanks very much for your comments. I appreciate it. And David Marotta is our guest. We're talking, we started talk about the countries with the most economic freedom, and we're going to go there right after this. Stand by for more of The Shilling Show. Underlying all of this is the whole issue of economic freedom. And you had come out with a terrific list about countries with the most economic freedom. And why don't we first talk about why that's important?
With a new guideline.
Yeah, the countries with the most economic freedom have the most gross domestic product growth. That correlation has been there. And countries with the most domestic product growth have the highest increase in their stock market on average. So we do a study at the end of every June to look at the countries with the most economic freedom and international stocks. And over this past year, international stocks performed about 2.5% better than U.S. stocks. And the countries with the most economic freedom added an additional 4.4% on top of that. Now, those numbers are still negative, unfortunately, because of how bad the U.S. economy has been.
Yes.
But losing 6.9% less in countries with the most economic freedom than you're losing in the U.S. is a big boost in returns and helps limit your losses.
So let's go right to the list. Very interesting case in point. Let's talk about the number one most free economically country. What is that?
The Freedom Index is put out by the Heritage Foundation, and number one for many years has been Hong Kong, which surprises most people. It's clearly in the top with top. There's 10 economic freedoms, and it has top scores in four of them. And Hong Kong is a very free. It is come out from under British rule in 1997. It has a separate constitution, a separate set of laws than China, and it is China's example of what it could be if it were a free market economy.
We are thinking along the same lines because I had a number of questions about that. But I guess the first thing is, I remember when Hong Kong was taken over from the British, there was this transition. You could probably tell me what year that was, but it was some years ago. And everybody thought that's the end of Hong Kong. There was panic. There were people leaving Hong Kong with suitcases full of cash. At least we've heard that anecdotally, coming to the United States to, you know, to be safe and keep their money safe. Why is it that the sky didn't fall? And why did people think it was going to fall in the first place?
Yeah, that happened in 1997. And everyone thought that China would ruin Hong Kong. In truth, I think Hong Kong is going to ruin China.
Now, that's good news. I consider that to be terrific.
Because China has been moving up in freedom. It currently still ranks 126th out of 157 countries. So it is still mostly unfree on the one hand. On the other hand, China knew they had a cash cow. They knew they had, in fact, a goose that laid golden eggs. And they knew that if they didn't mess it up, it would be of great economic benefit to them. And in truth, it has. China does not have the rule of law. It doesn't have freedom. It's difficult to invest in the country. It handles its monetary policy whatever way it wants. Its currency doesn't exchange openly. And Hong Kong has none of that. Hong Kong is free in every area that China is not.
So what actually happened when China took over? I mean, what did they do differently than what had been being done?
There was a little bit of a challenge of political rule, which was struck down in the Hong Kong courts.
And China abided by that?
China abided by it and backed off. So They have pretty much left Hong Kong alone, and I think they're glad they did.
I would imagine so. So how do we differ from Hong Kong? I mean, America's down the list a little ways, but I mean, when we look at Hong Kong, what is it that we could learn from them?
Yeah, there's 10 economic freedoms that the Heritage Foundation measures. The two that the U.S. is the lowest in is physical freedom, which is determined by tax rates, and it's determined by both the top income tax rate and the top corporate tax rate. And in the U.S., those are both 35%. And a lot of people worry about what the top income tax is for individuals, but the more important rate is what it is for companies. Even Europe, that has higher personal tax rates than us, has at times much lower corporate tax rates, because Europe understands that corporations don't pay taxes, individuals pay taxes. So the entire overall tax revenue in the United States as a percentage of gross domestic product is about 27%. So 27% of our economy is siphoned off and is not free. And in terms of government size, the government spending in the United States is almost 37% of gross domestic product. So again, we're deficit spending and we're having troubles there, but our government intervention in our economy, therefore, is much higher than places like Hong Kong or Singapore, Ireland, Australia.
Now, there are people in our listening audiences who probably heard you say something I was going to ask you, but you said it before I could, which is that corporations don't pay taxes, people do. We've got about a minute here to explain that, because there's people who still don't believe that, even though that's one of the first things they teach you in economics class when you go to college.
Yeah, corporations simply pass along whatever they pay in taxes in terms of goods and services. So every time you go to the store and you buy anything, you should pretty much count on the fact that you're paying an additional 35%, and it would be 35% lower if we didn't have corporate tax rates. It's a hidden tax. It's a tax on the poor. It's a tax on spending. And as a proportion of their income, the poor spend more as a percentage of their income than they're rich. So it's a very regressive tax. And it's a tax that hurts people when they're trying to get started and get going. It hurts capital spending because you have to buy things in order to get your business going, and you're paying a tax every time you buy something.
Wow. Okay. Well, see, I think it's really, really important for people to understand that, because we have a lot of screaming going on, particularly during the time of a presidential race, that, you know, those big greedy corporations, we've got to increase taxes on them because they're not paying their fair share. All right. 128 here on The Shilling Show. David Marotta is our guest. 977-1070 is the phone number. Going to take a break for news and then more of the countries with the most economic freedom. Stay tuned. Thank you so much for joining us. And 977-1070 is the number if you have a question or comment for our guest, David Marotta, who is the president of Marotta Wealth Management. We're talking about countries with the most economic freedom. We're halfway through the show and we've talked about only one of them. But we promised to speed it up a little bit. But we also take your calls at 977-1070. And David, in case people want to get in touch with you, I'll bet you have a website that they could go to visit you.
Yeah, they can go to www.emarotta.com. That's E-M-A-R-O-T-T-A.com.
Okay, terrific. So let's go. We talked about Hong Kong, which is a fascinating case in point, and we could spend all day with Hong Kong, but we need to go down the list. So let's talk about number two.
Singapore is number two. It's actually better to invest in Singapore, which does a lot of business with China, than it is to invest in China itself, because then you have the protection of rule of law and your investments, and you can take your money out of the country and the currency exchanges at a normal rate. And Singapore and a number of other countries in the top 10 economic freedom do a lot of business in China in that region and yet have much more economic freedom.
We have Gary who's on the line, line number one. Gary, you're on with David Morata. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, thanks. Good afternoon, David and Rob. David, I want to go back over, even today, these arguments are being raised. I want to go back to the housing situation. The idea that Fannie Mae and Fannie Mae are too big to fail is being thrown out there. And I don't understand that. I mean, in the same token, you know, that's being said. General Motors today, I believe, is you know, cutting back because of consumer changes in demand. And I just wonder if it's basically the politics of it, that this idea of market stability and market psychology, we've got to have a calm and tranquil housing market. And does that mean for us, you know, increased taxes and subsidies to that end of the market?
Yeah, most economists would say anytime you end up bailing out a large company, it hurts and destabilizes the rest of the economy in a very small way, but it's across the board. It's doing more harm than good. One way that economists would say it is it's too big not to fail. It's too big to bail out because the drain on the economy and the hurt to every other business that has to pay the bill for that is greater than the good you could do for bailing out something that isn't solvent in the first place. So it's a difficult argument. Most people look at the good being done, but they never look at the harm being done in terms of destabilizing the rest of the economic cycle.
Okay, you know, I certainly agree with you. And just right off the top of my head, government has been pushing home ownership forever. You know, I mean, I was thinking of the Community Reinvestment Act of 1977.
Exactly.
I mean, we could go on and on and on.
Even tax policy.
Yeah, it was the Community Reinvestment Act that was redone around 1996 by the Clinton administration in order to raise homeownership. That, in 1996, that was the legislation that allowed some of these subprime mortgages to be collected into structured investment vehicles. That was the one that required banks to make loans in the community that were not particularly solvent. And that really set up the housing crisis that we're in today.
Okay. All right. Take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Gary, thanks for the call. That leaves the line open at 977-1070. All right. So as we continue on down the list, and we could do a whole show just on that, and maybe we'll have to spend a day because I have lots of questions and comments as well. But okay, so we talked about Singapore. Number three. This one is astounding to me because there's been such a change here recently. Could we talk about Ireland?
Yeah. Ireland is the third freest economy. They have a corporate tax rate of 12.5%, which is incredibly low, far below the European Union average, far below the U.S. And as a result, Ireland has the second highest gross domestic product per capita in the entire European Union. They've been gotten the reputation as being the Celtic Tiger because of the amazing growth that they experienced during the 1990s. And that freedom makes them one of the best places to invest in all of Europe.
So let's talk a little bit about Ireland. I have a friend whose sister lives in Ireland, and I saw him at Christmas time, and he could be way off base, but he said, oh, Ireland's a socialist country. You know, they have a very high personal tax rate, and it didn't ring true to what I heard about them being so successful economically. Are they considered a socialist country as far as the you know, paying for insurance and all those sorts of things that we would normally associate with socialism?
You know, it's interesting. They're socialism and then there's socialism. If I can jump ahead to number eight on the list, which is Chile.
Yes.
Chile is clearly led by a center-left politician. She's part of the Socialist Party. And yet she has campaigned on a platform of continuing Chile's free market policies while also saying that she'll increase social benefits to help reduce the country's gap between rich and poor. Well, the best way to reduce the gap between rich and poor is to have a good economy in order to rise all boats and rise the poor, because the gap between the rich and the poor is always going to be there. And if you can raise the poor, that lowers the gap a lot better than having to worry about anything else. And the best way to do that is to have policies in place that help people start businesses. So back to Ireland, starting a business is business freedom is one of the things that Ireland has right. And business freedom is the ability to create, operate, and open a business. So, for example, in Hong Kong, that's number one. Obtaining a business license means filling out a single form. It can be done in a couple of hours. If you look at India and parts of South America, obtaining a business license requires endless trips to the government and can take over a year to get your business open.
Wow, that's a long time, and that certainly stifles creativity. And I do consider people who are entrepreneurs to be creative as well. So one of the interesting things about Ireland that I was reading recently is that they refused to ratify the EU Lisbon Treaty. And one of the things they mentioned they were fearful of was what they called tax equalization. And I guess, could you explain to us what that treaty was going to do and why would Ireland stop the whole thing and not ratify?
Yeah, I was also looking at some of that. When Ireland was asked to join the European Union, one of the things that they try not to do in the European Union is to compete with each other on the basis of taxes. And Ireland said all of our growth and prosperity is due to our tax policy. So why would we want to give up that sovereignty, raise our taxes to the levels that stifle our own growth just to be part of the European Union? And so you're right. Ireland is one of the few countries in Europe that decided not to join the European Union.
But there was a huge push from within all of the countries. And certainly Sarkozy was pushing this in France, and he was kind of the champion of this. But how is it? I mean, reading about it, there was a very interesting coalition of far right and far left, as they describe them, that were against this. But it was pretty close, wasn't it? And why is it that people thought it would be good?
Yeah, I mean, we have the same thing in the United States. States compete a little bit on the basis of their taxation. So you have the hybrid car manufacturer in California who wanted to move to New Mexico, and Schwarzenegger got all angry about it. And he said, we'll waive all your taxes if y'all stay in California, because it was such an embarrassment to California. Well, that's the competition we have in the United States based on just the state tax rate, which is low. Imagine if we abolished the federal tax rate and now all the states had to raise taxes to pay to the federal government, but they could raise them any way they wanted, and all the states started competing. There would be some states that would cater to having a very low corporate tax rate or a very low individual tax rate, and they would get all the corporations and individuals who had money
and
in
me.
That state, right? Exactly.
And me, right? I'll move there.
and that's actually what the framers of our country wanted. They wanted that state competition, but our federal tax rate sort of unifies everything and makes that debate and argument a lot less. Well, in the European Union, they don't have that. Every country has its own, and so they're trying to institute the leveling that we have with our federal tax rate. So it doesn't matter where you live, and it doesn't matter which country is the best, because they're all the same.
They're going, at least apparently, according to this conversation, in the wrong direction. Stop now while you still have a chance. It's 1:42 here on The Shilling Show. David Murata, president of Murata Wealth Management, is our guest. We're going to take a break and come back for the final segment. And we certainly will be taking your calls at 977-1070. Lines open for you right now here on The Shilling Show. Stay tuned. The final segment of The Shilling Show with David Murata. We're talking about countries with the most economic freedom. And of course, we're talking with you at 977-1070. So we left off at Ireland, a fascinating case in point, a country that has really turned itself around. Let's go to number four.
Yeah, number four is Australia. And the highest economic freedom for Australia is labor freedom. And labor freedom measures your ability to hire and fire people and your ability to have your salary go to the person and not go to non-salary costs of employees. And in Australia, it's very easy, as it is mostly in this country, to hire and fire people. You compare that to France's labor freedom, which is only at 63% on the measurement. In France, if you hire someone today and you try to fire them tomorrow, it can take up to 3 years for them to be actually fired.
Oh, my goodness.
It's almost impossible to fire someone in France. Now, they're trying to change that. But if you remember the riots that we had in Paris with all of the burning on the outskirts,
yes,
that was over a law that said, look, we can't seem to hire any of the young people because no one will take a risk on young person. So what we'd like to do is we'd like to give French businesses the right, if they don't like someone and they're young, to fire them.
Uh-huh.
And all the young people rioted and burned things in the streets. So if you're in France, all you have to do is get a job. You can never show up to it and you'll get paid for 3 years because it's almost impossible to fire someone.
That is amazing. And it sounds a little bit like Massachusetts. I've not lived there before. I had somebody tell me that it was almost impossible to fire somebody. And I remember being a kid in California back in the 70s, and my dad was in management there. And I remember him telling me how difficult it was. And every time they tried to fire somebody, there was a labor attorney there, and it cost them thousands of dollars. And they typically, at that time, it was tens of thousands of dollars. They typically paid them off.
Yeah. In the U.S., we have in the United States, we have an interesting sort of hybrid between the two. We have small businesses and large businesses. And I think the threshold is 70 employees. Small businesses are not subject to the rules that large businesses are. So when you get to 70 employees, you don't hire anyone else if you can.
Right.
Because the rules for large employees are much more constrictive, and 90% of job growth in the United States comes from small businesses. So we have given freedom to small businesses because that's where we get most of the job growth and economic growth. We've restricted it for large businesses, and we're sort of halfway between the two extremes in terms of being restrictive and having lots of red tape and not being restrictive and trying to get the economic benefit from it.
And that's a good segue into number five on the list.
Yeah, number five is the United States. We have actually moved up. When I started looking at the Freedom Index, we were number 10 or 11. And
how long ago was that?
A few years, maybe four or 5 years ago when we started looking at this. And so the United States has actually been moving up in freedom, partly as a result of tax decreases under the Bush administration and some additions like that. We kind of bounce around. When we institute higher minimum wages, then our labor index goes down. But we are mostly free. And sometimes in the United States, people don't realize how incredibly beneficial the freedoms that we have are. I would say that economic freedom matters more in people's lives than political freedom. I know that's a controversial statement. But if you vote and you get outvoted, you have nothing. But if you have economic freedom, you have everything. You can decide what you want to do. You can start a business. You can make your own living. And those kinds of freedoms make more difference in your family's lives than anything else.
Was there a time in our recent history, I'll say within the last 100 years, when we were actually more economically free than we are today?
You know, the Heritage Foundation has only been keeping track for about 15 or so years, and so they have certain statistics, and they've been refining their measurement. So I don't know the answer to that question.
Do you have a sense of it? Like, if we look back to the 1940s or 1950s, was that a time when there were just more laissez-faire capitalism in America?
I would say the answer to that is probably no, for this reason. And the two things that I look at when I look at any politician's economics is I look at what they think we should do with a capital gains tax rate and what they think we should do with a corporate tax rate. Corporate tax rates and personal tax rates are as low as they've ever been since 1930. And if you remember, Kennedy lowered the top marginal personal tax rate from 90% to 70%. And everyone said, wow, you give a tax cut to the rich. Then Reagan lowered it from 70% down to 50%. And everybody went crazy saying, how can you give this tax cut to the rich? And yet it's the top marginal tax rate that makes one of the biggest differences on our economy.
And I remember being a child and learning that, people who were earning money were paying 70% of it in taxes and being absolutely astounded as a kid saying, how could a government possibly do that? I mean, how did they get away with that? How did it get up so high?
Yeah, it's interesting, too, because most people today don't remember that when Reagan lowered the top tax rate, he lowered it from 50% or 70% to 50%. And if you were to ask them today, what tax rate should we be at? They will never say more than 50%. And yet at the time, Reagan had such opposition to his tax cut for the rich.
Yes, I remember that. And it was a wonderful time in America of kind of reawakening of people's optimism and getting out and doing things. Okay, so will either of our major presidential presidential candidates bring us more economic freedom? Are either of them likely to move us up on the list from five and maybe bumping Australia or Ireland out of the way?
Yeah, and I think the answer is no. None of the two who are left, neither of the two who are left, have any intention of lowering either the corporate tax rate or the capital gains tax rate. So one is for keeping it where it is and reluctantly, I think, and the other is for raising it quite aggressively.
Oh,
so
boy.
In either case, I think we're in for bad times. For the individual investor, that means that unlike most years, this is a great year to realize your capital gains because we have a capital gains rate of 15%. And we're liable to have a capital gains rate in the future going forward of at least that or higher, maybe 28%. So I have one client, in fact, I was just working in the account yesterday, realizing as much capital gains as we can in the account, paying the taxes now, and then going forward, we can hold on to it, hopefully until we get capital gains rates that are as low as this again.
Or abolished completely. And I promise you, if you vote for me for president, I will abolish the capital gains tax.
There you go.
And the corporate income tax. Wow, what a shame. But it's unfortunate people have to plan around things like that.